Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
Welcome to the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Shirelli. I'm joined by Jeff Osterman today, and I'm going to tell this story, Jeff. So Jeff has 25 plus years in collegiate athletics coaching. He's impacted a lot of young athletes, and now he's transitioned to a podcast that he's running with his good friend, Layson. Is it pronounced Layson Perkins?
It is.
The Fifth Quarter, Conversations Beyond the Court. So Jeff knows this now, but we've been writing a book over the last year called The Everyday Warrior, A No-Hack Practical Approach to Life. I think it's going to resonate well with people. But in the final revisions, we put a quote in the beginning of every chapter. And for the preface, we ended up changing, making a last-minute change. And the quote is, there's nothing more powerful than a humble person with a warrior spirit who's driven by a bigger purpose. Signed, Jeff Osterman, who I have never met. We found the quote. We loved it. It absolutely resonated with what we wrote about. And no kidding, I would say about 1 week later, you reached out through MikeSorelli.com and said, hey, I'm Jeff Osterman, 25 years in coaching. Father was a vet. And we said, no freaking way. And that's what brings us here. But Jeff, I mean, 25 years being a coach and mentor to young athletes, not only competing at the collegiate level, I'm sure you have some stories. But before we get into those stories, just a brief background, where you come from and what led you to collegiate athletics.
Thanks. It's a privilege to be here, and we'll dive into that and we'll tell some good stories. But basically, grew up right north of New York City, played ball my whole life. When it came time for college, I could have played at a bad Division III, just decided that was enough. And I was going to be a business major, and something popped in one day. I figured I could be a coach. I did some camps, and a couple people took chances on me, and I entered college coaching and made a living, and I've gotten to go to some great places, meet some great people. But the end of my coaching life, I wake up, I'm in a Marriott out in Kansas, and I have the realization while I'm eating a buffet breakfast, my wife is raising our eighth grade son at the time, and I'm just not a present parent. And I felt I just got caught up into chasing my dream. And again, we had benefits, but it wasn't worth it. So we moved back. We're northwest of Orlando by about 30 minutes. Her parents are probably 20 minutes south of us. So we're really fortunate. I get to drive my son to and from school. And, I know my time's running out, but I wanted to leave my DNA. So I'm like Fred Flintstone at 4 o'clock. I go down the dinosaur tail. I work at a premier prep school, Montverde Academy, in the development office. I deal with athletic boosters. But most importantly, I'm a parent. And my buddy Layson Perkins and I decided to start the podcast. And in the beginning, it was coaches, but we pivoted to thought leaders, authors, military, veteran-owned businesses, anyone that can help. My back nine of my career is I just want to leave a legacy, even one person at a time, just trying to help people.
We often refer to it as the legacy of leadership that one leaves leaves behind. Good friend Rich DeVinny, who wrote the book Attributes, calls it the irony of leadership. Because when you think about it, the job of a coach, a mentor, a business leader, it doesn't matter, is to work themselves out of a job by making the next generation and those coming behind them that much better. And I know, having worked with a lot of coaches, and I love that you guys pivoted. There's a fascination in the business world, has a fascination with really two industries. One, the military, and two, coaches. And I think if coaches probably, you know, more probably the football coaches, but I mean, there's some coaching greats from the NBA that just are amazing. And I actually had, it'll come to me, NBA coach, one of the winningest, fifth winningest coach in the NBA. It'll Coach Carl on my previous podcast. I mean, the nuggets of wisdom these guys have over that, you know, the decades they coached, and the failures are absolutely amazing. Let me start by this. What drove you into coaching? I know one, you played basketball. Was there a coach you always looked up to in college basketball or pro basketball that you're like, man, I just want to be like that guy?
I loved my high school coach. I don't know if he was technically the best coach. He did football and basketball. But back in the day, I would do anything. I would never question. It's just what drove me. And I still can remember some of his talks. And so I didn't want to be like my dad and my brother, wearing the suit, coming home every day. I wanted to deal with young kids. I wanted to play a role. And these days, statistics are off the chart, you know, and I coached women for the most part. But there's so many father figures missing, male role models, that I really thought there was a need. Obviously, basketball, you know, they say great players aren't great coaches. Well, I wasn't a great player, so hopefully I was a little bit better as a coach. But I just saw the crystal ball of, it's not so much the X's and O's. You know, you can watch clinics, you can rent movies and coaching, listen. It's really about connecting with young people. And I just found that niche. I think listening was probably and may still be my best skill, that I really dive into the person, listen, kind of jointly come up with some goals and come up with a plan to attack them. So my high school coach, Mike O'Donnell, be one. And then I've met great people along the journey, but I just wanted to be involved with young people.
Isn't that amazing? The impact a high school coach had, probably not only on you, but you know, hundreds of other young men that drove them on to do great things. So I came back from New York, and you know this because we were scheduled for last week. I ended up being in New York and delayed, and I ended up on a United flight home from Newark. And I sit down, the guy sits down next to me, and it, you know, some simple airplane banner. And the guy looked familiar. And he's asking me what I did. And I said, I'm a retired military. And he said, oh, great. And it turned out to be Tom Herman, the former University of Texas football coach, amongst other universities. And we started rapping about our philosophies on leadership and culture building and working with young leaders, up and coming leaders. And he actually said the same thing. He actually had, you know, single family mom, single mom raised him. And every time he had a question about certain things about manhood, she always directed him to his high school football coach. And he said the guys on the team were his brothers, the coaches were his fathers, and that, you know, without them, he would not be, he especially wouldn't have played collegiate football. He would not be where they where he is today without those mentors in his life. So that's actually, there's a lot of parallels here, a lot of coincidences between you and I. As you know, a lot of coaches are transactional, and that's not only in collegiate sports or pro sports or the business setting or the military setting. A lot of coaches are transactional in nature. And I think by nature of the hierarchy, players will still do what the coaches ask and demand of them. What do you think sets aside a transactional coach from probably your style? Is it just you start with building that authentic, genuine relationship and go from there? Or is that just a work in progress across time? How does trust work into that equation for you?
I think it's the biggest thing. I think transactional may work for a game or a series of downs or a fourth quarter, but I think it's short-term, short-sighted. And we were even talking back when I was growing up, coach said something, you listen. If in your world, the military, there was no explaining why. You had a mission or a task and you did it. And now people can disagree and dig in their heels, but in everything, we're having to explain to this generation a little bit of more why we're doing certain things. And I think for you know, one of the biggest differences coaching guys and girls, I think, besides technical stuff, guys did not trust right away. Girls, they wanted to please you, but they were really, really careful about letting their guard down. So I think in both, the similarity was if you could connect to them, then you had them. I think guys, you had to be careful about fixing or correcting in front of their peers and their buddies, where girls, you would kind of take an approach for the team to succeed. I need you to do 1, 2, and 3. And I think by connecting with people, learning what makes them tick and what's their goals, you can remind them of that when you want to coach them. And one of my final questions in preseason meetings is, are you going to let me coach you this year? Because I know the secret sauce. I can get you. You showed me your list of goals, but you've got to be open to letting me coach you. And just like in anything, some people you push, some you pull, you've got to figure it out. And I think correction is the biggest thing on how you correct people. Some you can challenge them in front of their peers, and you know they're going to stick it up your ass and they're going to show you that they can do it. Others would just, you know, turtle, just go in the shell, and they're not going to respond. So I think you really, again, team success first, but you have to connect with the individual.
Yeah, the sum of its parts. You've seen a lot of cultures amongst the various teams you've coached. You've probably seen a lot of different coaching styles. What is that coach that you worked with that just created the ultimate team-oriented environment where people were willing to put their needs aside for the, let's say, the overall good of the team?
And it's hard. I think a coach is a leader, you know, someone that people will follow. In its simplest terms, that's what a coach is. Coaching, to me, is getting a group of people to accomplish a goal, hopefully a common goal. But these days, you may not like it, there are individual goals that come into it. If you were to look at sports, say golf, college golf, we want to win the championship, but there's 5 individual scores, so it's a little bit tougher. You know, coaching men's basketball, guys want their touches, their minutes, because they want to get drafted. Yes, we want to win, but I think one of the best examples, Bill Self at Kansas, who's won the conference umpteenth time, they said they will forget, these people out here in Kansas will forget when you were drafted, who picked you, what number, your contract, if you don't win the Big 12 conference. Because if you look up there, there's a lot of great players, but they've all won the Big 12 conference. So I think I love reading all types of leadership books, sports, military, authors, and kind of really it comes down to motivating people. Again, I can motivate my kids really well. If you're that much better, you probably beat me. But I think we're going to reflect. We're going to get every ounce that we can to make sure if we can't beat you, we're going to compete with you to the nth degree.
That's I couldn't agree more. I'm a strong believer that 1 + 1 = 3 if the culture is right. What are some of the core tenets you try to instill in these young lady leaders at the collegiate level? I mean, a lot of them were not going to continue on to the pro, you know, the WNBA. If anything, after their 4, 2, 3 years with you, what did you want them to walk away with that would set them up for success outside of basketball?
Yeah, it's funny that you always had the boosters that want to be involved in, hey, coach, how are we going to be this year? And my answer was, I'll let you know in 20 years when I can see how many CEOs, teachers, coaches, great spouses, parents, you know, that's, again, I would tell kids, and I was very honest in recruiting, and it changed once I became a father. I was a young, slick used car salesman. And when I had my son, something clicked and I changed my approach in recruiting to, I'm taking your most precious gift for 4 years. I'm going to tell you, we're going to win a lot of games. We're going to lose some games. You know, we had UConn in our conference who had won 94 in a row. And, you know, as much as you'd want to say, hey, we're going to win the conference, that was quite a challenge. But I will promise you this. I'm not going to promise you playing time. I'm not going to promise you awards and accolades. I promise that your daughter's going to walk across that stage, that she's going to be a better person and a better citizen, and she will have a supportive family. And, you know, and the only thing, and people would say, well, coach, why'd you do it? I said, I just like to thank you. And I would remind those parents, I said, hey, in 4 years, you know what I want? I want to thank you. And that's it. And we would have so many great laughs. But I think the DNA that I left on people is just an unwavering work ethic, you know, teaching you how to bounce back when you fail, because you will fail. Everyone's going to fail, especially with Connecticut and some other people, you know, but failing on the court on a Wednesday night doesn't mean you can just skip class and shut it down, you know, Thursday morning. You got to bounce back. And, yeah, so those are the accolades, the human trophies that I really loved.
Well, it sounds like you were trying to sell the parents on your character, at least let them know that their children were, young teenagers were in good hands. To what degree did you guys recruit for character over skill? Skill's important, and I'm not saying that. You have to have some bar or above the bar, the minimum of skill. But to what degree was character most important to you and the coaches?
Yeah, I think it's easy to – we could go to a gym and you and I can pick out, you know, you and I would agree on 7 out of the top 10. I might look for different characteristics that I'm fond of, you know, no hips and quick feet and big hands and things like that. But once you find who you want to recruit, and I'm sure it's the same in business and in most walks of life, then I want to peel back the onion and learn about them. That I want to see you, and parents are in the dark about, we don't really care if your team won in summer ball because you play 3 times a day. We don't really care if you win or lose. Sometimes I'd like to see you lose. I'd like to see, and I'd go to a parking lot. I'd pretend to be on my cell phone and I would watch how they would act, because their parents probably told them, hey, make sure, you know, coaches are here. Make sure you behave. You know, everyone's looking. But when you go to the parking lot, that's when you saw a lot of people just erupt. I think I want to go talk to the school lunch lady. I want to see how they deal with a referee after a terrible call, and really just figure out what makes them tick. You know, and I was never at a place where I was the top of the mountain, a Connecticut who could really pay attention to just talent, but they did a really good job of character. So for us, especially coaching a female sport, you know, you could think, Mike, you had a great practice. The next day you walk in, you had 3 girls here, 2 by themselves, 5 over there, and you have no idea what happened. But you know you got to play Louisville in a few days. And so I think character is what a lot of people don't. And I could go on about the transfer portal and every sport, that people are just chasing talent. And the old Brad Stevens Butler teams, why they won, they had maturity. They had the buy-in from guys, and they had that common goal.
Yeah. Talent will only get you so far. Courting a man or a woman, depending if you're a man or a woman, see a woman across the bar. The first ingredient is attraction. Talent is the first ingredient for sports or anything that you do. But then it's the team factor, because somebody who's not willing to play as a team or to put their needs aside for the good of the greater organization, like you said, because they want their points higher, they need their touches. That's gonna poison the culture. That is gonna poison the culture. And I see this. I use this in this analogy in baseball all the time. You know, the Yankees are usually the highest paid baseball team in the MLB, but they aren't always the best team. They have most of the best talent, but Then the San Francisco Giants come along, who, again, don't have as great a level of talent of leaders, but man, it's amazing what they can do as a team. Is they've got that factor, they've got that culture. It's everything. And I've seen even in the SEAL teams, there were platoons of 18 guys that had better talent, even though they all come from the same talent pool. And then there was a platoon of lesser talented guys, but just the humility was so tangible. And eventually they would overcome the other platoon.
I think it's kind of forgotten of the giving of yourself. And it's hard to explain it to young people. I don't know if I would have always got servant leadership, but that's what makes me tick now and what I do. It's really my legacy, and it's not my ego, quote, legacy. It's going to be what they tell my son about me when I'm gone, that the difference that he helped somebody less fortunate, or he stuck up and fought the good fight. That to me is my legacy and what's important. But people, they still want the accolades. They want the individual. I think it's a maturity, maybe, hopefully, that people catch on, that it's more power in we.
I don't think it's so much maturity, man, because you look at pro players and they never shed that attitude. And I would much rather be on a winning team where I rode the bench initially and I got in the second quarter than be the star player in a team that's losing. It's a no brainer. Everyone wants to be part of a winning culture as long as that culture is healthy.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
No, I'm 100%. I'm all for the team. And it's the memories, you with your SEAL teams, me with some of my teams. They're going to remember. They're not remembering you scored 30 points against so-and-so. They're remembering the great win where we came back or we had such a great trip together. And it's hard coaching when you have one superstar and 14 others down here. It's really, really hard to keep people these days with social media, when you break out for film sessions. It's really, really hard. Where if I had a choice, I'd rather 3 or 4 or 5 really good pieces instead of 1 or yeah. 2 great ones.
Yeah. It's, you know, as I think about it, the SEALs are much like a basketball team. You've got a star player, and then, you know, it's a talent distribution. Your best all the way to your worst, no matter what level you play at. Even in the NBA, the Chicago Bulls had the same talent distribution, just much further right on the talent sort of chart. But not one SEAL would have lasted more than 10 minutes had they gone on a mission by themselves. They'd be done on the targets we went across. It was almost like blood in the water. If somebody was so overtly about themselves, it was blood in the water. And it's almost as if the culture had a way of taking care of that individual by themselves, whether, let's just say they humbled them when necessary. Who's that player? And I don't want names, but give me the scenario, that player that was very, very good, that knew it, and how you dealt with that player to humble them, or at least put them on the path to humility.
Yeah. There's a kid still playing in the finals of the WNBA named Courtney Williams, and she was by far the best player in the building. But I would try to come up with team goals, team challenges that took her individual skills maybe away and kind of came up with more team goals. I would challenge her in a team drill about how much she could do to uplift other people. And really, you to break it down to the bottom level, our team wouldn't succeed as good as she is if she didn't have her teammates playing pretty well. We weren't going to succeed. So I think she had a pretty good buy-in. And then you just talk to her as a person. And that's probably the most proud I am hearing the stories. And I have some inside access about the fans in Connecticut, how well she treats them, how much they love them. If it's someone old, a little kid, she really makes time. And that was part of it, just becoming the whole person, not just a great pull-up jump shooter.
That whole person concept is powerful, and it's one we write about in the book. It's one I wrote about in this book right here. It's sort of the basis of how we assessed and select people into the special operations community is not only physically, mentally, spiritually, or you could say emotionally. How often were you looking for well-rounded people sort of within those pillars?
Yeah, I think it's huge. Just like in your world, you'll have your best, but if they're not bringing up the rest of the boat, I don't know if they're a great leader. They're a great individual. Yes, we tried to get the best talent, but always in mind knowing we needed a lot of pieces. And it's kind of like a puzzle. If those pieces didn't fit, and we had teams for that season where on paper, wow, we got a lot of talent in this room, but the puzzle doesn't fit. It's just individuals. It's different agendas. It's outside noise. And if they're not picking up each other, because everyone's having good days and bad days, I think same thing in a boardroom. And I think someday my leadership book is in basketball. There's so many skills that relate to business. We just happen to use a scoreboard, but it's recruiting. I'm trying to get the best sales team possible. You know, we have scrimmages and exhibitions. We review tape. We work on fundamentals and culture. All of those things all carry over to a boardroom. But we all know sometimes chemistry, it's hard to describe. There's no secret sauce, but you know when you have it. And it's even more evident when you know you got crap chemistry and you've got to figure out how to get through and manage egos and the seasons.
Well, it all translates. Anyone who doesn't think that what we did in the military or what you did in collegiate sport doesn't translate to what they do, I will. This is where I'll stand my ground and say you're wildly wrong. And to say that business doesn't use a scorecard, oh, hell yes, they do. You know, one, there's QBRs where they're setting the yardstick, the measurements for the previous or the next quarter. KPIs, OKRs, it's absolutely the same thing. Business absolutely uses a scoreboard. You know what? I always like to say this. At the end of the day, you're selecting athletes into your program from probably multiple different states. In the military, I didn't get to select who my troop chief was. It was like an arranged marriage. And you've got to find a way to build some shared adversity between those two people. And they've got to make that relationship work amongst, much like your five players. They've got to find a way to build relationships. And relationships, in my opinion, don't always mean that they're best friends. It means that they can work together. One of the things we often hear is this person a culture fit? And what people are really saying is, do I like this person? When rather they should say, is this person a culture fit? And by that, do I respect them? And do they have values that align with my values? And if they do, whether I like their personality or not, that's fine. That's a me problem. I can absolutely work with them come Monday to win whatever basketball games we have that week. I think people get that about culture. They completely get that wrong a lot of times. But translation, everything translates.
No, I agree. I think I may not like you per se, and we may not hang on a Friday night. But if I know you have my back, I may not like you, but if something ever happens, I'll be the first one there with you. And that's just real world. And we try to relate sports to the real world. And, you know, if you don't want to be that thumb. You don't want four people going in one direction and the thumb making a left turn, because just like in sports and tryouts, you'll get cut. They're not, unless you're that 1%, they'll make a change, a trade, whatever. And that's, you know, it's sad that some people don't get, sometimes you do have to look in the mirror, you know, and that's one of my big things in trying to teach young people. You got to reflect. You got to pass the mirror test every night that, you know, you did your best. You may not have passed everything or gotten perfect grades, but you got to be able to look in the mirror and know you tried. You know, take a, you know, we used to say 24 hours and bounce back.
The reflection piece, we talk about a lot. So I'm huge on this. One of the most common threads that I've seen amongst high performers of any industry, regardless of your profession, is reflection. The best and highest performers are always highly self-reflective. Now, I remember specifically guys that stayed into the SEAL teams 20 plus years, they had these, there's these green notebooks in the military you can go check out, and you can have as many of them as you want. And these guys were always writing in those books after every mission, after every training cycle, everything, every day. And they had volumes of books on their desk from the start of their career to the end of their career. But they all had this process where they were reflecting on a nightly basis, whatever that process was for them, of basically saying, hey, what did I do well? More importantly, what did I do poorly? And how can I fix that going into tomorrow?
I think journaling is so good for me because I do reflect sometimes too much, but I've got to make sure I just don't want to make the same mistake twice. Like, I want to make new mistakes. I'll learn from it, but I don't want to look back and go, wow, crap, I just did that. And like basketball, one of the things, and especially coaching females, is people would miss, say, a layup, something easy that you can do, but it would just affect their mindset for so long that I used to give them a rubber band. And I said, once you find yourself going down that slope, just pluck the rubber band. It will snap you physically, hopefully mentally, to, you know, the next play mentality. And, you know, I think hard coaching is baseball. So if you make 3 out of 10, you're in the Hall of Fame. But that also means you're failing 7 out of 10 times. And what if it's a slump and it's 14 in a row or 21? How is that mindset of that player, professional, the best? That's where it comes in that, you know, you've got to reflect, you've got to work hard, you got to look at tape, do extra reps, but you also have to be able to turn that page.
Easier said than done, my friend. We all know that. We've all been there. So you're saying your players physically had rubber bands on the court and you'd see them doing that?
Right. Yeah.
Where did you pick that up?
I don't know. Probably in some book, some journal, but just those kids that would really have a hard time. If I threw you a pass for a layup and you missed it, it might not be me messing it up. It was you, but my body language, my demeanor was, you know, you see it in all sports, the one person that, you know, throws their hands up in the air and, you know, look at me, and the vertical pronoun, they're an I person at all times. You know, those people get affected because Mike missed the layup or missed the cutoff, that, hey, snap back. You got to move on, next play mentality.
Resiliency is, I think that's something we try to breed in all our kids. I think as parents, sometimes we fail to let our kids fail. Is we're too overprotective, and we prevent them maybe from being scenarios where we know they will fail. But I'll tell you the one thing I saw, and we knew this because I went back as an instructor. Those who lived lives of struggle before they got to BUDS, to SEAL training, already had resiliency built in. So we saw NCAA athletes, some gold medalists, Olympics, Olympians, failed the training where maybe one guy was 5'5 and just had always struggled through high school, collegiate athlete, or anything else. Nothing came easy. And they were the ones that ended up making it through the training. And you saw them at the very, very end of the pipeline. We always found that people that faced a lot of hardship in life and learned how to pick themselves up by the bootstraps always did extremely well for themselves. Again, in contrast to athletes who things came naturally to and then ended up in SEAL training.
And I think I used to worry too much about the helicopter parents that were always around, hovering. I think the worst now, and my son's 16, so we did the travel circuit and all of that, is the steamroller parents that behind the scenes or in front, that they're just plowing the road so their son or daughter will succeed instead of failing or sitting on a bench or flunking a test or whatever it is, that they're going to whatever means they can is just steamroll and make an easy path. Well, if you don't ever have adversity until you're high school, college, whatever, yeah, I don't know the studies. You're setting yourself up for a big failure.
Late to the game, or prepare yourself to be able to steamroll that path for the rest of their lives, which as we know will be exhausting. You talked about journaling. What is it? What are those habits, man, that you got on a daily basis? Do you journal on a daily basis?
I do. I have a pad right next to my bed. So in the middle of the night, you think of something, you know, and sometimes it's upside downs and scribble. But I have a journal, and I have a bunch of them on the bookshelf now, of just either thoughts or things that I want to accomplish, maybe that I didn't think of because I was so involved with myself or with the sport, of just trying to help different people. Like with this podcast, of first it was just about Layson and I and some coaches, but then I was like, we have a little bit of a platform. Let's see how many other people we can help, you know, and if it's one listener at a time, that's great, you know, and it's something that I think it was my second or third year in South Florida, I started an angel giving tree, you know, and I had a tiny platform. We had a modest fans, but eventually the thing grew. You would see, quote, elderly people bringing in bikes that are assembled. And one of my last years, we had, I think it was like 300 toys. We had 8 bikes. We had gift cards. And it just, in my mind, it made a difference for people maybe that weren't as fortunate as me, that they woke up Sunday morning, you know, with a bike and a Batman helmet. And so I think more people just need to, you might not think it's a big platform, and it may not be, but I think listening, a smile, it's hard, you know, and I had great parents. You know, you see the person on the side of the road, and I know sometimes it's uncomfortable, but it's okay, as long as it's safe, to talk to somebody, to offer to help. Is there anything I can do? Sometimes they just want to talk. And so that's kind of what drives me, you know, right now. It's a little bit different. Yes, my hours are shorter, but I think journaling for me is, what's next? What can I do next to make a difference?
I agree with you on the standpoint of, hey, even a small platform can do so much good for many. What was it? Alexander the Great said, it's, you know, the actions of the few that dictate for the many, or the fate for the many. I think people need to refocus locally rather than beyond their immediate communities. And I think social media is to blame for that to a degree, is people are losing that sense of tribal nature or the community around them and just focusing on affecting that. And naturally, everyone knows if you create a really good local community, that's it's going to metastasize and it's going to grow and it's going to band out. I've got to ask you, do you drive your wife literally crazy by turning on the bedside table?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. But now the cell phone, if you tap it, it's got a light. I've probably driven her crazy, Mike, way before then. But not to go on a tangent, but with 9/11, being a New Yorker, my dad had worked in those towers numerous times. He was New York Telephone, 9X, became Verizon. But what a special, of course, the worst of the worst. But I just share the story about how people really took care of people. It didn't matter what you looked like, what you believed in. People really got down to taking care of each other. And I'm not some old wise owl, but I didn't know how long it would last. But boy, it really was impactful trying to tell, you know, my 16-year-old who's just going to read about it, that the world really was a different place soon after that, that people cared about each other and looked out for them.
I was just in New York, as you know, specifically for 9/11. And I did have time to make it to Ground Zero, which absolutely, the monument is absolutely gorgeous. But you're absolutely right. It should not take a tragedy in what 2,977 people that passed for us to come together. I'm forgetting where the quote comes from, but it's basically at the worst times we are at our best. And regardless of political disputes, you're absolutely right. It's amazing how unified our nation became. Flag sales went through the roof. People were enlisting to go bring the fight to those that had made those towers fall. But there is good to be found in bad times. And there's a great guy, if you ever have him on your podcast, Sebastian Younger. wrote a book called Tribe. And he talked about that during the Bosnian-Serbian conflict, that some of the, sort of encircled towns had to share electricity at certain hours and share food and resources. And years after the fact, a decade, he went back and interviewed him on those times. And some of the people said they wish they could go back because they treated each other with such respect. They were unified. And even though resources were limited and times were hard, they've never felt such a sense of community like they did when they were encircled. That is amazing. I think we get entitled, we get comfortable. And when we do, we miss the big picture.
Yeah. And you nailed it. It shouldn't take something catastrophic to bring us together. But even pandemic, when there was shortages of food, people around, we would ask neighbors, hey, I'm going to the store. If they have chicken, do you want me to get you any? Yeah, let me go get you money. No, I don't care about money. I said, just tell me, as simple as just asking and looking out for people. And, short story, we grew up in New York, right north of the city. And when you had a snow day, right, you were excited. You would have to, before anything, you had to shovel our driveway and our front porch. And then before we could go play pond hockey, my mom and dad would say, go across the street and start shoveling the neighbors. And I was like, what? They could hire someone. They could, why? And it was just, that's what we did, that we would do their driveway before we got to play ice hockey, and full circle. My dad, towards the end, he lived in that same house. And hand to God, we had neighbors that would bring his garbage pail down, would bring his newspapers to the front. And it was like a holy shit moment, like, wow, they're up there smiling because that's what they instilled in us. And it's sad, but people look at you crazy. If I were to go outside and grab my neighbor's garbage pail and start coming up the driveway, they would think I'm crazy. But in Kansas, that's what we did. We, the first time I saw my next door neighbor and he was Air Force, and I was like, wow. He brought up two people's garbage pails. And I was like, all right, I love this way of living. And, so that was really impactful. But it's sad it takes something catastrophic, pandemic or the towers or something like that.
If anything, from coaching these young leaders, what did you learn from them?
Yeah. Wow. Good one. I probably didn't realize how fortunate of a life I had. There was one young lady who I had recruited. She was a good talent, really liked her, got to know her. And within a short time, her father had gotten shot in a drive-by. So he was in the hospital and they said he was going to make it. She went to a tournament. He didn't make it. So when she came home, her dad was gone. And within, I think it was 2 to 3 months, her grandfather had passed. So she had no male figures really in her life. And I'm thinking she's at that time 16, 17. And I still had both of my parents alive at the time. And I'm thinking, wow, I don't know if I was a teenager, if I could really fully understand what she's going through. So I think to be appreciative of what I have and what I was given and to share it. I think, yeah, you can hoard it and you could have the most whatever it is, but okay, what good is it if you can't share it with other people or friends? And I think that really left a mark on my soul.
Did any of your former players still contact you and say, hey, coach, just want to say thanks?
Yeah, that's the best part of coaching, especially in junior college when they were with me for 2 years, we'd go to university and you'd get the call or the text that said, thanks. It wasn't that hard. You prepared me. I was meant to be here. I think that's in a nutshell why I coach, the relationships. And I'm kind of, my wife would probably another reason she would think I'm crazy, but I'm the guy that I'm going to win Powerball next week. I'm just a positive mindset guy that, and if I won Powerball, Mike, I'd have the biggest party. I'll invite you, but I'm inviting all my former players, and they're going to do impressions because they thought, you know, they're in the back of the bus doing imitations of me. Well, I was in the front of the bus probably laughing at them. But, you know, the sad thing is one of the first gals I recruited, I think it was 7-8 years ago, passed from cancer. But there was a few of our old players with her, and they called me on the phone, and she was just in pain. They you know, called me in, and it was so impactful that I could, you know, really just make her laugh at that time. You know, so I've been to weddings, I've been to births, sad. You know, I've lost players. We lost one of mine, I think 2 weeks ago. She was a successful, beautiful person out in Milwaukee, like Good Morning Milwaukee. And she had some mental demons that just, you know, were too tough. And it was just too tough for her. So those are the things. And she and I would talk and text 2 to 3 times a year. And I'm thinking, wow, was I too self-consumed? Was I not listening or not reading? Or, you know, so again, tragedy. So I've made a better effort, even in this 2 weeks, to reach out to not just players, but friends and college roommates and people that I haven't touched base. And to just say, hey, how you doing? No, really, how you doing? You okay? You need anything? You know, you can call me. And it's, I think if we all check on each other a little bit more, we can get through the bad day at work or not meeting your sales quota or, you know, failing a test or getting dumped by a boyfriend, girlfriend. But I think, again, it leads to that post 9/11. If we can check on people, yeah, it makes a difference. You know, and on the podcast, I'm learning obviously more and more about soldiers transitioning. And, you know, so that's something I want to pick up the cross and run with it in whatever way I can.
Yeah. The, you know, one, my condolences on the loss of your former athlete. You know, you just can't tell. You can't tell certain people. They you see them in the morning, they look great, they're smiling, and then all of a sudden they take their life that night because they're wearing a veneer. And yeah, we see this heavily in the veteran community. And I would like to think we're getting better, that people feel they can be vulnerable and say, hey, something's just off here, I'm not right, and just to ask for help. I need help are probably some of the three of the most powerful words you will ever hear. And I don't know why it's so hard. No, I'm going to take that back. The initial days of the Marine Corps, that wasn't a common phrase we used because we were so concerned that it showed weakness, when actually I think it's the opposite. It shows such a degree of moral courage. I need help. And when one person sees someone do that, the others around them may be more apt to actually ask for help as well. So again, my condolences on the loss of your player.
No, thank you. And I think, again, it's social media, right? Because it's all crap. We look at Instagram, you're having the perfect meal in the perfect sunset and, you know, everything's great. You're skinny, but we don't see the 17 other pictures that you took or the sacrifices you did. It's social media is what it is. It's not going to change, but we've got to get past that, you know, and I went back and looked at her social media and everything, and
little things.
There was no signs, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, behind this door is my wife, and she's waiting for me to finish this podcast because I've got what we call poop patrol, and I've held it off for a couple of days. But yeah, I'll never post that. It'll just be me and her smiling at the next dinner. Nobody ever. I wish people would post about their failures more often. But the thing is, when you put in, you're going to write a book. When we wrote a book, you know what the worst part about it was? Putting yourself out there, because these keyboard, I'm not going to call them warriors, these keyboard cowards, now hiding behind anonymity, can make these comments on social media about your book, about you, its character assassination. And so I think a lot of people are holding back from putting themselves out there or admitting their mistakes. And all I'd say is just that's going to naturally happen. It's go look up Teddy Roosevelt's man in the arena quote, disregard the people in the cheap seats. They always have comments. All you care about is the people in the arena to your left and right. And if they're picking you up and cheering you on, that's all that matters. I do agree with you. Social media is crap. It was, I think, you know, it does have utility of someone living in New York to maybe check in on somebody in California and see how they're doing or communicate. But it seems like we've emphasized quantity over quality, particularly with relationships. And I've heard that, like, oh, this guy has this many followers and he doesn't follow anyone. Like, how cool is that? I'm like, is it cool? Because your definition and my definition of cool are completely, completely different.
It is. And people they get caught up right into followers. But for 1995, I could get 1,000 followers before we finish this. You know, it is what it is. There is good for social media. I do see value in it. But it's hard, I think, for young people that are caught up into followers or you got this outfit or did you see those sneakers? And I think it's hard for young people.
It's comparison. And comparison is the thief of joy. That's what it's become. You know, where did I hear this? Was it Bill Maher? It might have been Bill Maher, his show. I'm pretty sure it was. They said they took a poll recently of Chinese kids in school, in contrast to American kids. And Chinese kids, one of the number one answers of what they want to be when they grow up is astronauts. And now in the U.S., do you know what it is? Social media influencers. That's the overwhelming majority of kids want to be social media influencers. Don't get me wrong. I'm using social media as a tool. And I have a team that run my accounts, but we're heavy on LinkedIn. By nature of the leadership consulting, we're heavy on LinkedIn because I do believe that that is the last bastion of social media right now. There's great conversations with leaders in the industry that happen there. But I'm not a fan of Instagram, Facebook, TikTok-y or Twitter. And I steal that from Amy Van Dyken. She calls it TikTok-y. Amy was a 6-time gold medalist. It missed my generation. I use it for business purposes and that's about it. End of day. Yep,
I agree. Yeah. I think LinkedIn is, again, it's probably an older generation that's using it. And we see more value in it in putting a question out there and getting substance versus you posting the perfect dinner at the beach, you know.
So we usually end these, Jeff, with a number of questions. And first one is hardest decision of your life.
For me, I was in the middle of my career in South Florida, and I got offered the head coaching job at another Division I North Florida. And there were some other reasons, but I remember, and I didn't have long to think, but I let too much doubt creep in, and I didn't bet on myself. And I went back and forth. I think, I was relying on loyalty, which turned out to be a one-way loyalty. But I think it was really hard. And looking back, I probably should have bet on myself.
What was your wife saying? Take it.
Yeah, she left it up to me. You know, JC was young and there were red flags. But again, at every job, there are red flags. But and I'm pretty self-confident on certain things, on most anything, especially basketball and my abilities in that to recruit the right kids and to win. But I kept thinking, oh, I'm going to get something better. Maybe this isn't. And I started making mountains out of molehills and I didn't have long, but I eventually passed on it. So that's one I kind of went back and forth on.
So this may be the answer to the second question, which is, what is your biggest regret? Probably that.
Business life, yes. Personal life. When my dad was near the end, he's up on Cape Cod between my brother and sister at the time. And we weren't sure. Things went really downhill very, very quickly. And I wasn't sure of when to get on the plane. He was telling me not yet. And my brother and sister said I had time. And eventually I said, okay, I'm going to just do it tomorrow, you know, screw everybody. And so, you know, I got on the flight, but he didn't make it. By the time I landed, I had a text from my brother, you know, so I'm ready to get off the plane, hop in, you know, I had a car service ready to take me. But yeah, so, you know, regret personal, I would say that would be it, that I didn't, you know, go up a day or two before.
It's amazing how often we hear that story where parents will tell their now adult children to stay. I'm fine. Cause they don't want to disrupt what you have going on. It's selfless in a way when you think about it.
Yeah, it really was. My mom was such great, great faith. And I remember towards the end, before cancer got her, I was in the hospital room with my dad and two Catholic priests when she received last rites. And I'm really strong in my faith, but I had never seen someone with so much faith. And I was like, I hope I can get to that point someday, because she told the priest she was excited to see Jesus. And I'm like, your body's ridden with cancer. You're in pain. You know, you're leaving your husband and three kids, but she was happy in her faith, right? That's what she lived her life for. And I was like, wow. I mean, it was beyond sad, but I was like, I hope I can get to that point in my faith.
That is sweet on so many levels. And I think there's a lot of people, to include myself, that wish we can get to that level before our time comes. And we actually are heading that direction. Before we do, what are those 1 to 3 leadership principles, traits, or virtues that you hold dear to your life that had that have led to the majority of your success? Those things that are non-negotiable in your eyes.
Yeah, I think for me, it's I mentioned it earlier about my legacy, you know, my life purpose. And I can tell you it has nothing to do with the wins, the losses, the awards and accolades. I think someday when I get up there, the big guy's going to say, did you do the most with the talent I blessed you with? You know, so for me, it's I want to be the best in everything. And it's a growth mindset that everything that makes me tick, I want to be better. I want to be the best friend you've had. I want to be the best short game chipper, putter. You know, I want to be everything. I want to be the best. But I believe really in my heart of servant leadership, and it's not so much selfish. The golf might be a little bit selfish because I keep getting my tail whipped, but I just want to help people. And it's amazing when you tell people, they ask, so what do you want, you know, for the podcast? What do you want us to be a sponsor? I go, no, I just want to help. I want to have new friends. I want to make a difference in people. And I think I'm really good for me. My number one thing is empathy. I think it's really important to listen. Like I have a sign somewhere back here, which is FAKE, which is faith, family, excellence. Faith, family, accountability, kindness, empathy, and excellence. And those are some of the traits that I hold dear that I hope my son will carry on, that he would pass on, that those things are kind of what makes me tick these days.
You know, this is twice that you brought up servant leadership, and I want to get your opinion on this because I think it's a term that's wildly overused and people sort of take on a sort of apathetic or passive stance as a leader. Does servant leadership, because you just said the word, also mean occasionally that you got to put your boot up one of your people's, you know what, and I'm not talking physically, I'm talking accountability. Servant leadership is also about holding people accountable to help them learn. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I think, again, a coach has impact of 15, a football coach, 100, you know, military, different amounts. But I think everybody can be a servant leader. To me, simply, it's one person at a time. Are you better after our engagement? It could be listening. It could be a smile. It could be a conversation. I'm still old school that I follow up with a written note and it's more about checking on people, you know, and sometimes I'll listen to you and I'll say, hey, Mike, can I be honest? Can I, you know, do you, it's like, will you let me coach you? Can I be honest and give you devil's advocate, another point of view? And if we have that trust, I think I value your opinion. That may be the boot, but I do want you to sometimes tough love. People say negative. I think, is, again, New Yorker, we're kind of a little bit more honest and blunt, but I think tough love's okay. Like sometimes I got to say things you need to hear, or, you know, being married, sometimes you need to listen to things that you maybe don't want to hear.
Accountability is how you deal with it. It's how you dish it out. And how you handle yourself in administering accountability. But I am a believer that the highest form of love or compassion is accountability. I mean, think about it with JC, your son. You know, you see him do something wrong. You're quick to come in and say, hey, why'd you do that? Did you think about the outcomes? Because you just, let's say you offended somebody. There was no reason for that. And how you handled yourself and holding them accountable, because you want them to become a good contributing human being, again, contributing to society and the community. But I think a lot of leaders shy away from holding people accountable and hence arguably are not in a lot of ways leaders.
Right. I can, do you sell your soul to accomplish one short-term goal, or are you trying to build towards the big common goal? And, you know, parenting, I related, and I remember when he was elementary school and we talked and I said, you know, in school, I want you to do your best. If that's an A, a B, a C, whatever. But the thing I would lose it on is if your teacher told me you weren't kind. I said, don't be one of those that, hey, if you got B's or all C's, but you were really, really kind, I can live with that. I'll support you. We'll figure out a way to try to overcome any weakness. But I just think so many people, again, steamroll towards what their desired result is. I'm just not one of those that I think, yeah, we'll work towards it together. But accountability, a lot of people just forget that those are lessons you got to learn. Otherwise, it's a slippery slope.
Well, accountability is also enforcing or teaching people. It's almost like discipline. If you look at the definition of discipline, it's external punishment for said name infraction. It's the same thing. You're trying to teach your kids to not sort of live off external discipline, but develop self-discipline. It's the same thing as accountability, to develop self-accountability, because there's nothing better than when one of your young leaders comes to you and says, hey, Mike, I want you to know I did this. I did it wrong. And here's how I'm going to fix it. There's no conversation to be had other than, hey, good job. So, we often use discipline and accountability. It's actually self-discipline, self-accountability, in my opinion, that we're trying to steer people towards. And ultimately, I judge people on behaviors, not what they say or the values that they put up on the wall. Jeff, one more question, and we've sort of alluded to it. When all is said and done, and Jeff Osterman is on his last few minutes, how are you going to evaluate whether you lived a life of impact and purpose?
Again, I've probably said it way too much, but it's that legacy of, did I impact people enough that maybe they reached an all-time low and I was the person that they called or trusted, or I motivated them to become, not just settle for good, but become great. And I think, you know, for me, it's an every night check is when I look in the mirror, you know, did I do the best job I can? Job parenting, job as a spouse, job as an employee, as a leader. You know, so those are the things. If I can keep passing those tests one at a time, I'll be happy.
Jeff, that's a great answer. And I will agree, you know, impact is the greatest currency in life. The listeners have heard me say that before. It's the truth, because you can't take any of this shit behind you with you. So that's all you're left with. And if you can be the single candle that lights 1,000 candles, then you lived a pretty damn good life. Hey, there is one. And I know this is, we don't have a script, but if there's any parents listening, there's one poem I used with my kids that I think just incorporates everything you and I, Jeff, have just talked about. It's called The Prayer of Tecumseh. And it is one of the most powerful, of course, Tecumseh was a warrior, exemplified a warrior in the fact that he understood war was necessary for the protection of the innocent, but he took no pleasure from engaging in the act of war. But it's one of the most powerful poems. And I'll tell you what, I will butcher it probably. We will write it out within the transcript of this podcast and put it out for all. But go look it up after this. I think you'll love it. And anyone else who Googles it and looks it up, it is the ultimate sort of lesson, the nightly lesson for children. Jeff, where can people find you and follow you? Because everything you've said is just, you put out all these great nuggets of leadership and wisdom from your 25 years. Where can people find more?
All the social media is Coach Osterman, COACHOSTERMAN. It's Coach Osterman at yahoo.com. And the podcast is called It's the Fifth Quarter Conversations Beyond the X's and O's. And then my other entity is fullcourtdreams.com, which basically a lifetime of experience. I wanted to help young people who didn't know all the answers or all the BS that comes from college coaches, and help young people get athletic scholarships and be able to get an education. So it's kind of a consulting side hobby that I really like. And, you know, how do you answer a coach, you know, an interest letter? They want to come to camp, or just different things that parents know sometimes their child is talented, but they don't know how to go about it. So really any of those, and I respond to everything I get.
I bet you do. And we finished with it. We'll end with it. Again, this quote from Jeff Osterman was just, it explains it all. There's nothing more powerful than a humble person with a warrior spirit who's driven by a bigger purpose. Jeff, I can't thank you enough for joining us. And for all those that are listening, thank you for joining the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Cirelli, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show and pick up a new issue of Men's Journal Magazine. Men's Journal Magazine has features on health and fitness, adventure and travel, style, and my favorite, the coolest gear hitting the market today. Until next time, I'm Mike Cirelli, and thanks for listening.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.